Chapter 8. Sure, we saw no forced labor. When we approached anything that looked like it, we closed our eyes tight and kept them closed. We weren't going to lie about it. Jimmy Abbey, American photographer, 1933. I assure you that if I see something which I don't like, or which, if revealed in the United States, might create an unfavorable impression, I will keep quiet about it. The greatest desire of my life is to improve Soviet-American relations. Wendell Willkie. Up to 30 books on the Gulag were published in Europe before mine, and hardly one of them was even noticed. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. There is no coming to terms with communism's battle against the free world without also coming to terms with the simultaneous battle waged between the David forces of exposure and the Goliath forces of concealment. It is in David's unhappy story of betrayal and defeat where I have come closest to the answers to the questions that became a driver for this book. Why Soviet crime never made a dent in public consciousness, and why the Soviet fall wasn't cause for widespread affirmation. In turning these questions over, I keep coming back to that first speech Solzhenitsyn gave in the USA on June 30, 1975. I find that it contains a set of clues to all of the mysteries that relate to that undetected crime I began setting up some chapters ago. In 1975, Solzhenitsyn, like the witnesses and investigators who came before him, and also after, Jones and Muggeridge, and Lyons and Utley, and Valtin and Krivitsky, and Dyes and Bricker, and Bullitt and Earle, and Van Vliet, and Kravchenko, and Bentley, and Chambers, and Jordan, and McCarthy, and Epstein, and Conquest, and Bukovsky, and others, still seemed to operate under the assumption that principles of logic were universal, that adherence to them, that trust in them, was the distinguishing basis of the non-communist world as he and all the others once thought they knew it. It was a world, they all seemed to believe, in which ideology did not trump all, in which ideology had not infected all, certainly in which communists, fellow travelers, their dupes, and innocents, had not penetrated and occupied all. According to the old set of rules, rules that were permanently upended in what may best be understood as the red plot against conclusions, the logical presentation of hard facts would spur debate, understanding, decision, and action, and in the nick of time to avert disaster. In Solzhenitsyn's maiden American speech, it seems clear that he still believed that the truth which he, with his special knowledge and unique stature, could marshal, would serve as the essential catalyst in a most salutary and restorative chain reaction. It was so simple. Recall Solzhenitsyn's string of figures that encapsulated America's post-1933 capitulations to totalitarian communism. 17 a year, 10 a month, 1,000 a month, 40,000 a month. Surely the implications of this number set were obvious. The United States must halt its immoral and submissive accommodations and take action to reorder a moral universe long ago knocked off its axis of principle. Let the historians worry about why it went out of whack, Solzhenitsyn also said. He was here to present the facts that would, in their effect, put everything right. Little wonder the Soviet regime considered Solzhenitsyn dangerous. His novels and other works, beginning in 1962 with One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, were narratives of searing revelation. As Solzhenitsyn himself would later write, the Soviet regime could certainly have been breached only by literature. Indeed, the Soviet regime expended much energy and resources on shoring up this breach, as the voluminous KGB record on meetings and deliberations about Solzhenitsyn shows. Declassified by Boris Yeltsin in 1992 and published in Russian the next year, in English in 1995, this long, weird dossier of secret Soviet documents, including minutes from Politburo sessions and Central Committee meetings, memos, reports, letters, bugged conversations, and interrogation records, unfolds like an anti-literature of its own, showing how it was that a writer, a novelist, a single man without an army or any power, became the nemesis of the male-fisted dictatorship, all for the ultimate anti-Soviet crime, exposure. Yes, exposure is exactly the same crime that Lyons and Chambers and Matthews and Bentley and Jordan and McCarthy and all the rest committed in speaking out against the sinister workings of that same male-fisted dictatorship here. Rather than elevate these heroes to liberty's pantheon, however, we salute the hardened agents of Stalin for invoking the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination to this day. In fact, what was taking the Fifth, as so many communists did before Congress, but a tactic to protect Moscow's conspiracy to destroy this country and control the world? Rather than applaud the truth-teller's courage to break ranks with this conspiracy and bear witness, we regard as shameful their acts of exposure. But what was naming names but stripping American traitors of their conspiratorial anonymity that made it possible for them to serve a malign, foreign dictatorship? These are the questions that celebrated Broadway and Hollywood director Ilya Kazan asked himself before he finally decided to testify frankly and fully, including naming names, in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1952, 17 years after leaving the Communist Party. Wasn't what I'd been defending up until now a conspiracy? Working for another country, he wrote in his 1988 memoir, Ilya Kazan, A Life. Hadn't I watched my comrades staggering through political switch after political switch by instructions not written in this country? Was the question really what the comrade said it was, the right to think what you will and say what you believe? Or did it have to do with acts, allegiances, and secret programs? The answer Kazan came to was this. I believed that this committee, which everyone scorned, and I had plenty against them too, had a proper duty. I wanted to help break open the secrecy. There was no way I could go along with the communist crap that the CP was nothing but another political party, like the Republicans and the Democrats. I knew very well what it was. A thoroughly organized, worldwide conspiracy. That crap, that the Communist Party was just like any other political party, became the crown jewel of that thoroughly organized, worldwide conspiracy. The precious, if false, cover story that had to be polished and displayed at all and any costs. Not that this fakery was always believed. In certain quarters, it was always recognized for what it was, crap. Going back to the early days when, as historian Paul Kengor notes in Dupes, CPUSA leaders were surprisingly open about publishing Moscow's instructions to them. As we've seen, 25 years after its 1919 founding, the fact that the CPUSA, its underground offshoots and fronts, made up a Kremlin fifth column in the USA, had become an issue in the 1944 presidential campaign when GOP vice presidential candidate Ohio Governor John Bricker raised it. In 1950, CPUSA claims of kinship with all other political parties, past and present, was eruditely debunked by Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson in an opinion. Still, the crap kept coming on back. It never went away. Proofs of American communist subservience to Moscow remained mainly and elusively circumstantial. At some tipping point, probably after the destruction of Joe McCarthy, the crap became consensus, sometimes uneasily regarded or even quietly rejected consensus, but consensus nonetheless. It was an honest-to-goodness party line. There was no conspiracy overseas and funded by Moscow to overthrow the USA. American communists were just a bunch of harmless, idealistic, and homespun progressives, freedom of conscience and all that. Of course they deserve to be left alone in peace and privacy and secrecy. Have you left no sense of decency? Director Edward Dmytryk, the one charter member of the Hollywood Ten, who later broke communist ranks to testify before Congress as a friendly witness, analyzed this breathtaking scam in his 1996 memoir, Odd Man Out. What thousands of confused liberals have believed was that one must allow a seditious party to destroy one's country rather than expose the men and women who are the party. In other words, naming names is a greater crime than subversion. That's what I call the mafia syndrome, and I find no shame or indignity in rejecting it. Naming names is a greater crime than subversion. In this mantra, confused or not, lies one of the greatest big lies the Goliath forces of concealment put over, the inversion of morality. When unmasking the nation's secret enemies became a greater crime than their secret war on the nation, they won. This was not only the belief of confused liberals once upon a time, it remains the essence of consensus today, particularly as the whole era further recedes from memory. By now, we have only the most basic keyword associations. Taking the fifth, freedom of conscience, as American as apple pie. Naming names, what stool pigeons do, crime. Actually, working incognito on behalf of a murderous dictatorship of thugs to subvert the U.S. Constitution and advance totalitarianism is the only crime here. Just not according to the communist paradigm, Americans learn to accept no questions asked. Thus, the Kazans and Dmytryks and other friendly witnesses remain traitors in the fuzzy lens of dimming memory. No one thinks to sharpen the focus by asking, traitors to what? The answer, of course, is traitors to the evil empire. Thus, our true heroes were branded with the 20th century's scarlet letter, A for anti-communist. There was no bricks and mortar gulag for them. Their punishment was social, professional, and also political, what Eugene Lyons called a species of intellectual ostracism that was the price of rebellion. But it was forever. On the occasion of Kazan receiving a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1999, half a century after he identified for Congress eight communist agents serving Stalin, the biggest butcher the world has ever seen, next to Mao, 67 years after the terror famine, 60 years after the blood purges, 59 years after the Katyn Forest Massacre, 52 years after forced repatriation and servitude and death of 2 million in Europe, 51 years after Viktor Kravchenko proved the crimes of the Soviet system in a Paris courtroom, 53 years after Hungary, 31 years after Prague and the documented revelation of Robert Conquest's The Great Terror, 25 years after the publication of the Gulag Archipelago, 17 years after martial law came to solidarity-inspired Poland, 16 years after the shoot-down of KAL 007, 9 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 6 years after Yeltsin admitted the USSR was responsible for Katyn and partly opened the archives, before Putin sealed them again, the surviving Stalinist remnant in Hollywood rallied to fresh applause to protest Kazan's betrayal. Judas, we were supposed to hiss at the 89-year-old director. Rat, we were supposed to spit. Indeed, the cover of the Village Voice, marking Kazan's Academy honors, depicted a sweaty Kazan grasping a rat-shaped Oscar. The putatively mainstream New York Times carried a column by Maureen Dowd, who castigated Kazan's efforts to unmask the secret agents of totalitarianism as scuzzy, and lionized one such agent, communist blacklisted screenwriter Bernard Gordon, 81, who co-organized the anti-Kazan protests with former communist blacklisted screenwriter Abe Polonsky. "We must protest everything Citizen Kazan stood for," said Gordon, giving off an odd whiff of Robespierre. Polanski, 88, went on to say, "I'll be watching, hoping someone shoots him." Such nice people. Brimming with bile, the extremely old left still hated Kazan for having gotten away with his apostasy. Had he, though? When Kazan died at age 94 in 2003, His lionizing obituaries were also studded with pointed rebuke. A trailblazing director. A theatrical and screen giant, yes, but he named names. He anchored people. And his decision to inform on others prompted many in the arts to excoriate him for decades. Inform on others? Note the verb of darkness and the innocent noun. Kazan decided to break silence on a treasonous cabal operating under Stalin's orders. Should he have been excoriated for decades for that? Not unless his book of deeds was written from the point of view of the Politburo. But so it was. That's the point. As Kravchenko understood long ago, Moscow's subversion of the American mind, the winning strategy of the Goliath forces of concealment, was its greatest success. When Solzhenitsyn, preceded by part one of his magnus opus, The Gulag Archipelago, was ejected into the West, he presented this same set of communist conspirators and fellow travelers with a new version of an old problem. How, in the face of his formidable witness, to maintain the pretense that the USSR was not a moral monstrosity that had destroyed and enslaved and broken millions of people? It's not at all the case that Solzhenitsyn was the first emissary of this grimmest reality. Memoirs and scholarship of the Gulag filled Western bookshelves for decades preceding his works. As early as 1949, for example, a New York Times reviewer could describe Soviet gold, Vladimir Petrov's testament to his 6 years as a slave, laboring among the Dokodyagas of Kolyma, or prisoners who have been reduced to the lowest level of physical and moral degradation, as another addition to the already extensive list of memoirs by former prisoners of slave labor camps. I, for one, certainly didn't realize there existed any such already extensive list in 1949, but so there did. Not just a list, either. In 1951, a book called The Soviet Slave Empire by Albert Conrad Herlain was said by the New York Times to have earned a special place in the whole library that has already been written on the subject. The whole library that's already been written on the subject? That the Gulag wasn't news will come as news to many readers. It also deepens the mystery about our numbness toward Soviet crime. If a decent Gulag library in 1951 was anchored by the seminal 1941 book Forced Labor in Soviet Russia by David J. Dalin and Boris I. Nikolaevsky, in which the authors demonstrate that 10 million to 15 million slaves were at that time powering the Soviet economy, why did we still need to wait 2 and 3 decades for the findings of Conquest, the life story of Solzhenitsyn, the suffering of Sakharov? That said, looking back, it turns out the Dalin-Nikolaevsky book was quite influential. Not only were the authors famously and fatuously denounced at the UN in 1947 by the ubiquitous and terrible Andrei Vyshinsky, then Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister. We last saw him fixing the docket at Nuremberg to exclude Soviet war crimes. As complete idiots or gangsters for their thoroughly corroborated research into Gulag suffering, but in 1960, the conservative quarterly Modern Age credited the book with creating a public furor that made forced labor a liability in the propaganda wars for the USSR, which, after all, claimed to be a regime representing the workers of the world. As a result, Modern Age wrote, Kremlin leaders whittled down the institution of Soviet slavery. Modern Age summed up, it is not too much to say that thousands of people owe their freedom to events set in motion by this book. Solzhenitsyn himself may well have been among them. A quarter century later, he would hit us on the head with that 1800-page trilogy of his. To be sure, he wasn't your average anti-communist émigré, an international celebrity before he crossed Andropov's KGB. The celebrated novelist was a darling of thaw. He offered Khrushchev-approved proof that Stalin's regime, retroactively in bad odor after some of the nasty bits about it had seeped into Western consciousness, had been a communist aberration, a tiny band of extremists, you might say, who had hijacked a great political philosophy. However, the author's renewed persecution and suppression by the post-thaw communist police state under Brezhnev, symbolizing the persecution of so many others, threatened the high gloss of 1970s normalcy that made friendship, détente, parody, world peace, and of course, moral equivalence, possible. And, more than possible, so alluring to the West. "We're all the same, you know," as the Le Carré darling said. Solzhenitsyn bore witness to the falsehood of this popular conceit. In fact, the more indelibly Solzhenitsyn engraved the reality of the communist police-come-slave state on the West's radar screen, the more jeopardized was the whole moral equivalence brand, which, as we've seen, had its tragic origins in recognition back in November 1933. The more Solzhenitsyn laid waste to the West's record of Soviet appeasement, the more garish and lurid the political spectrum of Politburo red to Roosevelt pink appeared. This explains why the elite Western embrace of Solzhenitsyn was always cold and stiff. Arm's length was the only way to keep Solzhenitsyn's blacks and whites from getting all over those gorgeous Le Carrelian grays. The irony is rich. What we learned about the Holocaust made us excoriate the German people for turning a blind eye to Nazi camps for the 12 years their country was a National Socialist police state. What we refused to learn about rolling Soviet Holocausts made us congratulate ourselves for turning a blind eye to Soviet camps for the 40-50 years we so often apologized for and enabled the communist police state. Nothing had changed since the 1930s when Eugene Lyons observed that people defended executions in concentration camps in Russia and went purple, denouncing the same phenomena in Germany. Solzhenitsyn threatened this impossible balance. "No other regime on earth," he wrote in the Gulag Archipelago, "could compare with the Soviet Union, either in the numbers of those it had done to death, in hardness, in the range of its ambitions, or in its thoroughgoing and unmitigated totalitarianism. No, not even the regime of its pupil Hitler, which at that time blinded Western eyes to all." Maybe it was for this particularly apt equivalence, Soviet-Nazi, not US-USSR, that Solzhenitsyn became one of KGB chairman Yuri Andropov's personal obsessions, as Andrew and Matrokin write, and also a thorn in the underside of the West. Ah, so, the forces of concealment, East and West, had a common enemy in the forces of exposure, East and West. Soviet Nazi equivalence was the equivalence, so patent as to be obvious, that dared not breathe its name. It called too much attention to the sordidly symbiotic liaisons between the enlightened left and the Stalinist left. Given a shared discomfort, then, it might be said that Andropov did Western elites a favor when he expelled Solzhenitsyn from the USSR in 1974. Somehow, the KGB boss sensed that taking away Soviet citizenship and forcing freedom onto the Nobel Prize winner would ultimately diminish the writer's voice and shrink his image as the man against the regime. At the very least, life in the West would wear away the imposing mantle of suffering witness that endowed the author with his rare sanctity. Outside the Soviet Union, speaking and writing in uncensored opposition to the communist system would no longer carry the same risk, nor exemplify the same courage. It might even invite a new critical scrutiny. What sounded brave and soulful in dreary Moscow might sound shrill and repetitive and worse, anti-communist, in storybook Switzerland, which is where the author first took refuge. Andropov, meanwhile, didn't trust exile alone to neutralize Moscow's Solzhenitsyn problem. He also directed the KGB to execute a multifaceted plan to destabilize and discredit Solzhenitsyn and his family in the West. It was, Andrew and Matryokhin write, a plan striking for the enormous priority and resources devoted to it. Solzhenitsyn's Swiss menage, for example, was penetrated by a band of Soviet agents posing as Prague Spring dissidents, up to and including the Czech translator of Gulag. Even more disturbing, though, is that KGB active measures were probably unnecessary to undermine Solzhenitsyn in the free world. He, his family, and his gravitas arrived in the West during the high days of détente. Never mind that détente was always a ruse, a sham, as Brezhnev himself declared in a secret 1973 speech to Communist Party leaders in Prague, to enable the Soviets to keep their diplomatic togs on while building military strength and, importantly, terror networks. Never mind that British intelligence passed along Brezhnev's secret between us communist declarations to this effect to American officials, and someone leaked a version to the New York Times. Never mind that the British considered the Soviet dictator's admission of the tactical sham of détente to be dynamite, comparable in importance to Khrushchev's secret 1956 speech admitting some of the crimes of Stalin. Notice how it is that we all of us know from our narrative about the Khrushchev secret speech. The Brezhnev secret speech, however, remains almost entirely obscure. Emphasis on the former moved the Soviet program forward. Emphasis on the latter would surely have set it back. The Brezhnev report was as welcome as a dose of chickenpox as far as Henry was concerned, an unnamed source told the Boston Globe in 1977. Henry would be Henry Kissinger, of course, high priest and night nurse of détente in the West. He managed to inoculate his White House team against the Brezhnev speech, or, in other words, he convinced others to discount the implications of the report, which directly threatened détente, rapprochement, arms control, summits, exactly where the 1970s were at, or at least supposed to be. Chalk another one up for the Goliath forces. The 1970s were also all about Soviet expansionism into the Third World, sensational kidnappings, bank heists, airport shootings, strings of hijackings linked to the rise of international terrorism. But never mind. So what if this organized unrest initiated a new age of Islamic jihad that flourishes three decades later? We may forget, but throughout the 1970s and beyond, red terrorists from Europe and the Islamic world struck at civilian targets from Italy to Sweden to Japan to Israel. Not that we ever thought of that world as Islamic. It was always described as Arab. Often directed by Cubans, Arabs, and Czechs, these forces were clandestinely bankrolled, trained, and supported by Moscow to destabilize the West. Such were the findings of Claire Sterling, published in The Terror Network, the groundbreaking 1981 book that became a Bible to the Cold Warriors of the incoming Reagan administration due to its expose of the Soviet-sponsored international network of communist and again, less noticed at the time, Muslim terrorists. In effect, the Soviet Union had simply laid a loaded gun on the table, leaving others to get on with it, Sterling wrote, summing up the Soviet modus operandi as evil clockmaker of international terrorism. Once again, the response of Western leaders to the Soviet assault on Western society was an official flight from reality, as Sterling put it. She describes what was by then the familiar mode of Western behavior, a mass avoidance of all the densely accumulating evidence that led to the conclusion that the Soviet Union was the culprit behind the chaos and terror. This led to a group hug around delusion. The phenomenon would be familiar to Robert Conquest, who has observed the Western impulse to avoid judgment on Soviet crime through undue concentration on reputable or reputable-sounding phenomena. This leads, he writes, to an attempt to tame the data, or, perhaps more correctly, a mental or psychological bent toward blocking the real essentials the real meaning. Why? Why would anyone want to block the real meaning of anything? In the cases where facts are discarded for their gross incompatibility with the principles of ideology, it comes down to a panicky impulse to avoid scrapping the ideology, especially if doing so necessitates the unpleasant exertions of self-defense. Surely this defines a kind of mental cowardice, perhaps a new kind. The new big lie that arose in the 1970s was to save not only the Soviet conspiracy, but also Western face. This led to the delusion that there was no such thing as Moscow-directed terrorism. Rapprochement was the answer. It sounded nice in French, and it was protected by a fresh onslaught of disinformatia from the West as much as from the East. Solzhenitsyn's voice threatened the whole phony passing parade. What could official Washington do but look the other way when he arrived in 1975? It was the old ostrich routine. Closed doors at the Ford White House, something about the president's scheduling difficulties. If the 1973 British Intel report debunking detente had given Kissinger chickenpox, it's easy to imagine him breaking out in hives at the approach of the Russian author 2 years later. Naturally, as Dr. K later put it at a press conference called to explain the Solzhenitsyn snub, he personally had enormous respect and admiration for Solzhenitsyn. Why, Kissinger continued, Solzhenitsyn's work is one of the few unclassified documents I have been reading. And everyone knew what an admirably, enviably busy man he was. This country can well afford to listen to Solzhenitsyn's views, he continued, without worrying what effect it will have on the foreign policy interests of the United States. Of course, there was a but. Busy Kissinger could make time to read Solzhenitsyn. Americans could well afford to listen to him, but senior White House officials couldn't meet with him. In that German-inflected monotone, Kissinger explained, from the point of view of foreign policy, the symbolic effect of that can be disadvantageous, which has nothing to do with a respect either for the man or for his message. Why does this sound so familiar? We respect the man and his message, just not their symbolic effect on foreign policy. Why, show Solzhenitsyn the respect he deserves, and the Soviets might think we actually believe their regime and its totalitarian system are from hell. Up and down, it was the old story. Facts, sure, but conclusions, nyet. The evils of the system, yes. The system is evil? No. There was that wedge again. Claire Sterling, busy tracking KGB activity through the 1970s terror decade, stumbled into it and reported in her book, incredulously, about the repeated failures or refusals of Western officials to assess glaring evidence of Soviet culpability, Soviet strategy, Soviet aggression. It was denial, concealment of the terror famine, the show trials, the blood purges, Katyn Forest, and so much more all over again. Only this time, denial didn't suppress the facts about barbarous attacks on the captive peoples of the evil empire, but rather about barbarous attacks against our own people in our own Western societies. We had hit new lows again. Shockingly enough, Sterling herself, the Cassandra of Soviet terror crime, was subject to the same syndrome of denial. In her foreword, as she prepares to introduce readers to the Moscow-supported networks of Marxist-Leninist revolutionary terror gangs, united by their efforts to destroy lives, property, peace and freedom in the non-communist West, Sterling strikes a note of preemptive apology for the truths she has uncovered. It would have been easier, she begins, to write about right-wing terrorists. Always a virtuous point. She continues, writing about left-wing red terrorists did not make me feel virtuous. It saddened me. few of us, in my generation or my children's, can easily shake off the belief that the left is always and necessarily good. Et tu, Claire? Sterling's comment is testament to the awesome powers of the belief in the big G goodness of the left, the political, cultural catch-all term we use to encompass all abstractions and ideologies of the revolutionaries and reformers who were and are naive or egotistical or zealous or power mad enough to force utopian transformation on the rest of us by government fiat, by mandatory inclusiveness, by police-backed diktat. We can chalk up at least 100 million murders to its most successful alumni, as tallied by the Black Book of Communism. But the animating spirit of the left still retains its glow, its catechisms archaic but basically unchanged, the faith long having become a hardwired reflex. Left, good. Right, bad. The people, good. We the people, imperialist. Individuals, especially businessmen, greedy. Hollywood blacklist, bad. Hollywood 10, martyrs. Except Squealer Dimitrik. Elia Kazan, Judas. Communists, persecuted freethinkers, have you left no sense of decency? McCarthyism, repression. Mao, expensive, decorative art. Che Guevara, fashion statement. Ho Chi Minh, agrarian. Mommy, who's Ho Chi Minh and what's an agrarian? Scratch Ho. The signposts recede from view, but the direction is fixed, which is why evil empire still triggers that patronizing chortle to make Pavlov proud and earn his dog a cookie. How Neanderthal can you get, says the roll of the eyes. No answer is necessary because our minds have been battened down against logic and morality both. 17 a year, 10 a month, 1,000 a month, 40,000 a month. Solzhenitsyn's moral calculus, like Conquest's compendia of communist slaughter, or Bentley's eyewitness evidence of communist treason, or Bukowski's detente nightmare in psychiatric hospitals and prisons, remains beyond our ken and comprehension, much like Solzhenitsyn himself, who was virtually locked out of the White House in the summer of 1975. 24 years later, Elia Kazan had to be sneaked into a side door to receive his special Oscar to avoid pro-communist, pro-100 million killed protesters in front of a Los Angeles theater. In the meantime, Solzhenitsyn never really got inside with his story, the one he always wanted to tell us Americans. The historic trigger for him was a toast Franklin Roosevelt made to Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin in late 1943 at the Tehran Conference, the first of two utterly disastrous wartime meetings of the so-called Big Three, in which the Soviet Union presented its measurements for the Iron Curtain and Britain and the United States helped him hang it. You want some more Poland? Help yourself. The Baltics? Why not? Those 2 million anti-Bolsheviks in Western Europe? You're right, Uncle Joe, they should be shot. To the gulag with them. Here, let us help. That was still to unfold when Captain Solzhenitsyn, probably glued to a radio in a cold encampment somewhere in Europe's east, got stuck on a point of principle. As he recalled it, the American president's Tehran toast went like this. I do not doubt that the three of us, meaning the Big Three, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, are leading our peoples in accordance with their desires and their aims. Solzhenitsyn and his comrades were aghast. How could FDR say such a thing, that Stalin, the blood-drenched dictator of fear, was fulfilling the Russian people's desires and aims? Did Roosevelt believe that? As Solzhenitsyn said in his 1975 address, how can this be understood? Let the historians worry about that. At the time, we listened and were astonished. We thought, when we reach Europe, we will meet the Americans and we will tell them. How poignant. those Red Army Rover boys actually seem to believe. We will meet the Americans and we will tell them, and everything will be all right. This wasn't naivete exactly. It was just the regular old ways of thinking, of assessing what Orwell called neutral fact, of analyzing the situation and judging it. In essence, Solzhenitsyn believed 2 + 2 does indeed equal 4, not 5. This, however, contradicted the ideological order. It was the same honest impetus of logic that drove an older and more seasoned apparatchik, such as Viktor Kravchenko, to defect and fire his salvo in the New York Times against the Soviet regime in April 1944, and, later, to go to court to prove his claims and win in Paris in 1949. It was what inspired World War I veteran and businessman Major George Racy Jordan to request leave from his Montana airfield to knock on government doors in Washington in January 1944 to tell somebody with clout somewhere that something fishy was going on with Lend-Lease. It was what impelled American aristocrat William C. Bullitt into the Oval Office to plead with FDR to start facing those same facts in early 1943. And it was what would move ex-POW Major John Van Vliet to jump the line home from the war's end to tell what he had eyewitnessed at Katyn. The same goes for frightened, defenseless Ivan Krivosertsov, who would make his way on foot from Soviet-occupied Bremen to the Western Zone during that first summer after the war in Europe, driven to tell what he had seen America's bosom ally do to thousands of Polish officers in those dark woods, terrified he would be murdered by the NKVD first. So it went for all the others, all of whom believed they possessed the clinching, cinching evidence necessary to show, to prove, that a contest between deceived good and deceptive evil was taking place. Just tell the truth, they thought, about the lies, the crimes, the secret plots, and the all-out war against morality, truth, and liberty would be exposed and thwarted. This was our army of Davids fighting for exposure. Common sense, common decency, natural reflexes, they assumed, would take care of everything else. I italicized natural reflexes because the surprise and irony is that there weren't any. Or rather, that they had been reconditioned to respond to new and very different stimuli. Solzhenitsyn, of course, never made it to the Elbe. On February 9th, 1945, 3 months shy of Germany's unconditional surrender, he was arrested by the NKVD in eastern Prussia for the crime of criticizing Stalin in a personal letter. He had told a joke. He was sentenced to 8 years in the gulag. At that time, this was considered a mild sentence, Solzhenitsyn would write, matter of fact. 2 days later, on February 11th, 1945, millions of people living in Europe's east and 2 million more scattered by war throughout Europe's west were also convicted and much more severely sentenced to life and, in many cases, death. They had been secretly condemned to Stalin's custody at Yalta by Allied agreement on the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe, which we mostly know about, and Soviet repatriation, which we mostly don't. In contemporary terms, repatriation was a policy of reverse ethnic cleansing that scrubbed Western Europe of displaced or captive Russians and other nationals claimed by the Soviet regime. Who did the scrubbing? The sick-making fact is, British and American troops. Between 2 and possibly as many as 4 million people were thus transferred, often forcibly, with many hundreds of thousands of these unfortunates becoming slave laborers in the gulag. Which presents us with a truly fearful symmetry. Just as Soviet occupiers couldn't have reached Eastern Europe without American Lend-Lease trucks, millions of Soviet refugees couldn't have ended up in the gulag without British and U.S. soldiers. Here was a harrowing new development in our self-destructive relationship with communist Russia. Having swallowed any number of big lies about Soviet atrocities, the terror famine and on, to maintain sunny relations with the USSR, having perpetuated a big lie ourselves about a Soviet atrocity at Katyn to continue to fight on as supposedly like-minded allies, the Western allies went further still. We became accessories to a Soviet atrocity, a war crime and crime against humanity. How did this happen? There are many factors to consider. With unseemly enthusiasm, the British took the lead on the repatriation issue, and we followed. Despite the moral consternation of U.S. diplomats such as Joseph Grew, who, as acting Secretary of State, balked at the policy. Again, the fix was in. Historian Nikolai Tolstoy writes that negotiations at Yalta on the issue appear to have been handled chiefly by Alger Hiss, the inexperienced Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, being ill-equipped to conduct them. Correction. The inexperienced Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, being the loyal protege of agent of Soviet influence Harry Hopkins, and therefore you bet ill-equipped to conduct them. Meanwhile, as State Department official J. Anthony Panik would later testify under oath before Congress, Hiss exerted Svengali-like influence over the mental processes of Junior Stettinius. So, if Soviet spy Hiss presided over the repatriation issue, who presided over Hiss? In his 1994 memoir, Soviet spy master Pavel Sudoplatov, whose duty it was to prepare psychological profiles of the members of the American delegation at Yalta, wrote, "I had the feeling that Hiss was acting under the instructions of Hopkins." Creepy feeling, no? Hiss would journey from Yalta to Moscow, where, Venona tells us, he would be secretly decorated by a grateful Soviet government. Was he regaled with Soviet testimonials about how he had fended off an existential threat to Mother Russia, even as Solzhenitsyn was at that very moment beginning his prison sentence for anti-Soviet behavior? Hiss, after all, had helped ensure the destruction of the anti-Bolshevik masses in free Europe, many hundreds of thousands of whom had actually taken up arms against the communist dictatorship by serving in the German army. Some were German-captured slave laborers. Others wanted to fight the communist dictatorship under any flag. According to Julius Epstein, who broke this story wide open in 1973, Epstein himself, a refugee from Nazism, whose trailblazing 1949 research triggered Congress's inquiry into the cover-up at Katyn. It was the 850,000-strong army of General Andrei Andreevich Vlasov, having gone over to the other side to save their country from Stalin, and having later surrendered to U.S. forces in German uniform, that formed the core of those forcibly repatriated between 1944 and 1947. In effect, then, we helped Stalin liquidate a potentially history-changing anti-communist rebellion before it could begin? Yes. Once again, the implications are stunning, even overwhelming, particularly given the enumerated toll of suffering and death that blackens this unreckoned stretch of Allied history. Now an obsolete road, long overgrown and forgotten, Uncle Sam and John Bull once traveled it together to betray an anti-communist army of nearly 1 million soldiers to death and to the gulag. It was truly the last secret, or one of the last, of the Second World War, Solzhenitsyn wrote of repatriation in 1973, when Julius Epstein's research into Operation Keelhaul, the U.S. Army code name for the forced repatriation of Soviet POWs and displaced persons, first became public. Notice how Solzhenitsyn hedged his bets, or one of the last. This was wise, as it turns out. He continued, "Having often encountered these people in camps, I was unable to believe for a whole quarter century that the public in the West knew nothing of this action of the Western governments, of this massive handing over of ordinary Russian people to retribution and death. This massive handing over of millions of refugees from the USSR, from generals of armies to intellectuals, Cossacks, kulaks, teachers, peasants, men, women, and children, took place practically within earshot of the gavels of the Nuremberg trials, then in session. Occasionally, the deportations made the papers at the time, piecemeal, to be sure, and without a sense of their scope. At least something about them was reported nonetheless, and in the prominent pages of the New York Times. Dateline Dachau. 10 renegade Russian soldiers, in a frenzy of terror over their impending repatriations to the homeland, committed suicide today during a riot in the Dachau prison camp. 21 others were hospitalized, suffering from deep gashes that they inflicted on themselves, apparently with razor blades. Many suffered cracked heads from the nightsticks wielded by some 500 American and Polish guards. January 20, 1946. Dateline Rome. Many thousands of persons hostile to the present regime in the Soviet Union are being forcibly sent there by Americans and the British under the Yalta Agreement, Eugene Cardinal Tisserand asserted today. And he said that the Catholic Church constantly received appeals from displaced persons terrified of being sent back to territory now controlled by Russia. The Cardinal gave the writer the permission to quote him, saying, "It will compromise me, but the world must know of these things." March 5th, 1946. The world must know of these things. We will meet the Americans and we will tell them. The world, the Americans, didn't care. Just like the admiral who had to check with his eye man back at the beginning of the book. It wasn't knowledge or information that anyone needed or wanted to judge for himself. The facts could all be neutralized in an ideological interpretation. Following the appearance of the Dachau story, General A. Denikin, the elderly former commanding general of the White Russian armies in the years 1917 to 1920, which were supported by the USA, not incidentally, in our completely forgotten first war against the brand new Bolshevik regime, wrote an extraordinary letter to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the commanding general of the European theater. The Russian general wanted to explain to this modern colossus why it was that his countrymen preferred death to repatriation to the Soviets. The letter, dated January 31st, 1946, was also a plea for their lives. "Presuming that you are not fully acquainted with the true story concerning these people," Denikin described the extenuating circumstances that led these men to serve in Nazi Germany's army, none of which he asserted had to do with Germanophiliaism. They hated the Germans, he wrote. He described the harrowing experiences of Red Army soldiers captured by Nazis. The exhaustion, the cattle cars, the bayonets, the cold, the death toll. Their starvation and bestial treatment, as Nazi-certified Untermenschen, their decisions to accept rations and freedom as conscripts in the German army, their desire to join the ranks of the Anglo-American armies. "Now," he continued, "they knew exactly what awaited them in Soviet paradise," he wrote. "No wonder, on being assembled in Dachau, they sought immediate death, cutting their throats with small razor blades, suffering unimaginable agonies and tortures, setting fire to the barracks, discarding their clothing to burn quickly, baring their chests to American bayonets and bowing their heads to American clubs. All this not to get into Soviet prisons. I can imagine the feelings of the American officers and soldiers who participated in such executions. General, there are the provisions and the paragraphs of the Yalta Treaty, but there are also traditions of free and democratic people, the right of asylum. There are military ethics which prohibit the use of violence even on the defeated enemy. And finally, there exist the Christian morals which call for justice and pity." No soap. Not only did Eisenhower not yield, he didn't reply. Not personally, anyhow. Perhaps, in Conquest's words, it would have broken his concentration on reputable or reputable-sounding phenomena and ruined his attempts to tame the data. His chief aide answered the Denikin letter on February 18, 1946, with a flat statement denying repatriation was forcible except under certain circumstances, all of which happened to apply to the Russians. Thus, at least 2 million people were repatriated, and we, the people, knew nothing or little of it until 1973, when Julius Epstein, an indefatigable truth-teller, told the supposedly last secret. Who was listening then? What do we as a people know of it now? American and British soldiers shed tears as they carried out the orders to club and blackjack prisoners into insensibility, hold them down at bayonet point, bind the cut arteries with which they had attempted to commit suicide rather than be returned to Stalin's justice, shoot their feet so they could not run, toss maimed and mangled bodies back into trucks after beating them into unconsciousness or drugging them into insensibility. Still nothing. When Epstein's book on the subject, Operation Keelhaul, The Story of Forced Repatriation, the product of 20 years of research, of painstakingly prying the release of repatriation documents from the U.S. government, came out in 1973, unforgivably, no review in the New York Times. Epstein could report that there had been at least some public debate in the 1950s on Britain's prominent role in this crime against humanity. Government ministers, including Winston Churchill, then Prime Minister, were publicly quizzed in Parliament about the operation. In the United States, Epstein noted, not one of the surviving high officials responsible for Operation Keelhaul has yet been asked any questions in the Congress. With the exception of the testimony of a few witnesses, including Epstein, who came before Congress in 1956, the Congress and the American people have never been officially informed about the basic facts concerning Operation Keelhaul, past and present. To my knowledge, the same holds true 4 decades later. In this way, this suppressed history of repatriation has reverted to the status of academic curiosity, a line of exotic research with no relevance or impact on us as a nation or on our history. In this way, we lose, for example, the impact of the American betrayal of Vlasov, all the worse since the Vlasov soldiers surrendered to the British and the Americans after they had been expressly invited and after they had received solemn promises that they would not be returned to the Soviets against their will. Epstein explained the deeper implications. The Vlasov people wanted to fight Stalin and Stalinism, a regime certainly not better than Hitler's Nazi regime, but were condemned by the West for one reason only, that we were allied with Stalin's terror regime. We had gone over to the devil. Our corruption was complete. Vlasov's Prague Manifesto of November 14, 1944, could stand next to our own founding documents, but we rejected him and it. Vlasov wrote, "There is no worse crime than the one Stalin commits, of destroying countries and suppressing the people who strive to preserve the land of their forefathers and build their happiness by their own labor." These were the words of the people who gave the lie to the myth, which was by then part of our own belief, that the USSR was a natural ally of democracy and freedom. They had to be destroyed for that. Vlasov continued, "The Bolsheviks robbed the people of freedom of speech, freedom of political conviction, their personal liberties, free choice of domiciles and travel, freedom of profession, and the opportunity for everyone to take his place in society in accordance with his capabilities. They replaced these freedoms with terror, party privileges, and arbitrariness toward the individual. We helped destroy them, or so we helped destroy them. Who was pulling the strings, or who from communist-occupied Washington was pulling the strings. Are such questions unfair, as in, have I left no sense of decency? Or are they logical, even bloody obvious? Decades later, they remained unanswered, unasked. Epstein's magnificent contribution to the historical record virtually ignored. 1 year after Epstein's book came out, to little if any mainstream acclaim, a Russian writer suddenly appeared in the West to give the lie to the same tedious overriding myth of Soviet democracy and freedom. This unarmed literary celebrity couldn't be destroyed. His fame was too great. His eyes, the lines on his face, his beard, too familiar. Could he perhaps destroy himself? It was as a Nobel Prize winner, an international bestseller, and a Gulag state exile that the Russian author returned in his 1975 speech in Washington, D.C., to the same theme that had driven them all as young men. But now, after great delay, the same hand has thrown me out of the country, and here I am. After a delay of 30 years, my Elbe is here today. I have come to tell you, as a friend of the United States, what, as friends, we wanted to tell you then. My Elbe is here today. Now at last I cross this final frontier. I break this last barrier. I reclaim my opportunity, stolen so long ago, to bring you Americans, good guys, and last best hopes, the facts you need, the facts you are missing, obviously. Because otherwise, subtext, why would you behave so weakly, so irrationally, so immorally? What doesn't seem to have been evident to the great sage was the extent to which we Americans had already closed ourselves, or pace communist infiltration, and we only knew the half of it, the extent to which we had already been closed to the calculations, political and moral, he finally had the opportunity to lay before us. In other words, Solzhenitsyn's Elbe might well have been here today in 1975, but there just weren't very many of us left on the riverbank to greet him. But nor would there have been in 1945. Surprisingly, it is to World War II where we must direct our attention, searching for our missing gaps. We must fill in what's missing from this period, even if it is inevitable that what makes us whole also breaks our hearts. As a cultural bulwark, a great wall of history dividing a traditional past from a postmodern present, World War II has long represented a break in the human experience practically as significant as AD and BC. Looking back, the burnished image of the USA circa 1945 stands out, an admirably simple engine of moral clarity that powered an epic, black-and-white fight against unmitigated evil, Nazi evil. This, as we have long been taught, was the singular evil in the world, at least until we diagnosed our own post-war conditions of chronic isms and phobias. As our history books tell us, it was the existential threat of Nazi Germany that spurred finest hour America into action, driving the aw-shucks Avenger to smite evil into rubble and make rubble into new cities. Wasn't Roosevelt, as the accepted lore would have it, devilishly clever to figure out so many cunning tricks to get a legally neutral country like the USA into the fight? He had even made neutrality a plank of his presidential campaign in 1940, lying through his teeth, clenched around that cigarette holder the whole time. Wasn't that wonderful? I hope at this point it's needless to say that the view through these red, white, and blue-colored glasses completely camouflages the hammer and sickle that was growing like a catastrophic cancer in the shadow of the swastika. This was the dark vision we were denied by our communist-occupied government, the core historical plot we were waved off even as we as a nation enabled its advance, our blinkered outlook set by the propaganda the communist-penetrated U.S. government created, controlled, and disseminated. We became victims of our own propaganda, as Hanson Baldwin put it, and he didn't know the half of it. It wasn't just the cloak of his popularity that Roosevelt cast over Stalin by recognizing the Soviet Union, as Time magazine put it, as early as 1934. It was the systematic censorship and suppression by the U.S. government from Roosevelt on down of all critical truths about the Soviet Union. This meant the systematic censorship and suppression of the truth-tellers beginning with old Dr. Wirt. It meant Goliath's total war against David.
I have noted with concern your plan to publicize your unfavorable opinion of one of our allies,
FDR replied to a query from his erstwhile political ally and European emissary, former Pennsylvania Governor George Earle, whom we've met earlier. The date was March 22, 1945.
I do not wish you to do so. Not only do I not wish it, I specifically forbid you.
Just to make sure, Roosevelt ordered Earle to Samoa for the duration. A few days after Roosevelt's letter went out, Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall issued the following order. Censor all stories. Delete criticism Russian treatment. With this March 26, 1945 order, Marshall silenced returning American POWs, whose great misfortune it was to have been liberated by a hostile, abusive Red Army. Of course, these ex-POWs were the lucky GIs who actually came home from Soviet custody. As many as 20,000 U.S. POWs did not. A hidden moral stain expanded on below. The concerted institutional effort to conceal Soviet crime could become absurd at times. After British POW James Allen fled German captivity in 1940, for, he thought, the relative safety of internment in then-neutral Russia, he sustained so much in the way of beatings, brutal interrogations, and solitary confinement at the hands of his Soviet captors that, following his release, he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, second only to the Victoria Cross. His medal, however, came with no citation, no written record, which of course is customary, of the conditions under which he distinguished himself. Allen's ordeal at our allies' hands was officially null and void. This is especially nettlesome, given that his story was well known to the highest British and also American officials. The first boat available to take Allen home from the USSR happened to be carrying British and American dignitaries from the first Lend-Lease Conference in Moscow in October 1941. The one that Harry Hopkins was controlling from his White House bedroom, as noted earlier. Allen, having just been released from the bowels of the Lubyanka, wasn't well enough to climb into a hammock or even drink a glass of whiskey, but he was able to tell his whole story to many of his powerful shipmates, first to the captain, then again to Lord Beaverbrook, the pro-Soviet British Minister of War Production, to Lord Ismay, Churchill's chief staff officer and military advisor, and later to Averill Harriman, Hopkins' Lend-Lease man in London. Goodness gracious, call off the agreement with these monsters to whom we have just pledged $1 billion and enough Dodge trucks to occupy Eastern and Central Europe, they all didn't say in one voice. They said nothing, and neither did Allen, whose personal account, prohibited from publication until 1947, 2 years after the war ended, lay in a cupboard at his home in Yorkshire. His book, which is titled No Citation, ends with his return to England, where he boards a train to his home. A railway officer he met on the train obviously was very reluctant to believe my story, Allen wrote. Incredulous is probably more like it. After all, the railway officer had no context, no officially, widely acknowledged body of facts into which Allen's story could fit. Reading such accounts makes it clear that even had Alexander Solzhenitsyn evaded arrest and made contact with Americans on the western bank of the Elbe, their drive to Berlin and points east, not at all incidentally having been abruptly halted by Washington to allow the Red Army into Central and Eastern Europe, it is highly unlikely anyone would have regarded him as a modern-day Paul Revere. I can almost prove it. On March 22, 1945, a month after Solzhenitsyn's arrest and the conclusion of the Yalta Conference, the British ship Arawa set sail from Italy on one of the earliest voyages of repatriation. It was commanded by a Russian-speaking British officer, Captain Dennis Hills, and carried 1,657 Turkomans, Muslims, Soviet citizens, many of whom had volunteered for the German army to fight communist rule. They and their multi-ethnic brothers in German arms from the USSR were a constant reminder, Nikolai Tolstoy writes, of the fact that the USSR alone of all the Allies had provided the enemy with thousands of recruits. Again, how could that be? Hadn't these Third Reich recruits heard OWI broadcasts exonerating the Soviets of guilt for the Katyn Forest massacre, as read on the air in the soothing voice of OWI's Elmer Davis himself? Hadn't they pored over the Siberia pictorial in the December 1944 issue of National Geographic magazine, with photos and text by Stalinist toady Owen Lattimore? Phony smiles and all, which even included happy snaps of Vice President Henry Wallace's trip to Kolyma, the ultimate gulag hell, where hundreds of thousands of people perished, and where NKVD authorities had gone so far as to dismantle guard towers and stock empty stores for the visitors' benefit. Hadn't they heard, as Harry Hopkins himself said, that Stalin was just not that kind of man? Seen Hollywood's 1943 agitprop classic, Mission to Moscow. Poor pre-defection Kravchenko might have cut his clenched palms with his fingernails during a screening of this Hollywood Hallmark card to Stalin's show trials, but, as Hopkins said, he was a deserter. Then again, so were these Turkomans, among the first of many hundreds of thousands of people to be carted to Soviet captivity, courtesy the U.S. and the U.K. Wait a minute, says the American brain, its brimming repository of good war nostalgia sloshing over its synapses. This is unbelievable, non-believable, as wildly out of place as poisonous toadstools in a fresh turf lawn. That lawn, those toadstools, symbolize the triumph of concealment. Facts have become something to uproot, weed out from the existing view of the world. One British veteran of a forced repatriation mission interviewed in 1990 explained that he hadn't spoken a word about his experiences at Bergen-Belsen, yes, that Bergen-Belsen, since 1946. He claimed that after British troops, himself among them, handed over a convoy of Soviet-claimed returnees previously housed at the ex-Nazi concentration camp, Soviet troops fired on the unarmed prisoners before British troops were out of earshot. The vet simply stopped telling the story, Nigel Cawthorn reported in The Iron Cage, because no one would believe him. No one would, could, or wanted to believe him. That's what happened on the Arawa, Tolstoy writes. Several men approached the Russian-speaking Captain Hills with an air of distress, asking what was happening. They seemed anxious about the reception awaiting them. It is not the Turkoman's fears so much as Hill's reaction to them that is critical to reckon with. Hills himself dismissed their fears with incredulity. Everything he had read or heard in the past 4 years led him to picture Soviet Russia as governed by men devoted to overthrowing tyranny and establishing the four freedoms. No, everything he had read or heard in the past 4 years had made him bulletproof against reality. In Captain Hills, we find the poster child of the age. Just like the Brits who disbelieved the war stories of forced repatriation or Soviet prison camps, Hills had been stripped of his mental tools, the building blocks on which to base any understanding of what these Turkomans were trying to tell him. He had been conditioned by Soviet propaganda as recreated and disseminated by the free world. Does such a state of controlled information not define an occupied territory? This was the same mindset that shocked Viktor Kravchenko. The greatest Soviet triumph, it was borne in upon me, was in the domain of foreign propaganda, Kravchenko wrote in I Chose Freedom. The American reflex to Soviet reality was either incredulity or cocksure denials. Solzhenitsyn would have had no better luck if he'd made it to the Elbe. His story, too, would have arrived like a square peg on a board full of round holes. What was he talking about? Let's not find out, because then we would have to do something about it. On first reading the Tolstoy repatriation book a decade or so ago, I recall thinking that even as the evidence was compelling, it didn't fit with what I knew about the Allied War. I had no awareness of the spiraling moral descent that led to this ultimate Western war crime. Without such awareness, what Tolstoy describes remains somewhat inexplicable. So, as history, it remains set apart. Just like the intelligence history that remains separate from general historians' existing view of the world, so too does the history of forced repatriation. Let these things into our flow of knowledge, and the mainstream is forever changed. That's why the bubble of denial must be protected at all costs. This explains why when Ronald Reagan came along and invoked, quite mildly, the evil empire, the whole world popped. Tap, tap goes the magician's wand. Stop looking. There's nothing here, anyway. Move along, back to what's real. Outrage over McCarthyism. Snorts over Dr. Strangelove. Scorn for the Red Scare. Scare quotes required. Gnashing teeth over the Hollywood blacklist, the Vietnam War, Kent State, American imperialists, male chauvinist pigs, fundamentalist Christians, Rush Limbaugh, Islamophobia, and always back to McCarthyism. In this alternate reality, it is the Neanderthals, the Reds under every bed nutcases, the anti-communists who rear their ugly, ugly buzzcut heads and 5 o'clock shadows and ruin everything. Make love, not war. Which is kind of where Solzhenitsyn came in. In that 1975 speech, he challenged us to rise to a moral level and admit, confess, the following. In 1933 and in 1941, your leaders and the whole Western world made an unprincipled deal with totalitarianism. Did anyone in the hall know what he was talking about? Uncle Joe? The good war that defeated Adolf Hitler? No context. He kept talking. We will have to pay for this. Someday it will come back to haunt us. For 30 years we have been paying for it. And we're going to pay for it in an even worse way in the future. What deal? What payment? How could there be anything unprincipled about defeating Nazism? Book sales hype and laurel wreaths notwithstanding, Solzhenitsyn's warning clashed with and was repelled by impervious consensus. No one knew the half of it naturally. Well, some people did. Still, from this very first moment, people may have applauded, but Solzhenitsyn failed to make much headway. Indeed, he progressively lost steam. It wasn't long before secular, self-indulgent elites would find it easy to dismiss the writer for his religiosity, his Russian nationalism, or his antipathy for popular culture. It was the holes in our own understanding, holes of our own making, that swallowed up the substance of his simple message, the point he embodied as living proof, literally, of the evils of communism. It was more complicated than that, though. As an ex-zec from the Gulag, as totalitarianism's witness, Solzhenitsyn also personified an indictment of American appeasement, collusion, and complicity with those evils, and, as Kissinger put it in his gruff monotone, the symbolic effect of that can be disadvantageous. You can say that again. Famously, Solzhenitsyn would take refuge inside 50 fenced and barbed wire acres in Cavendish, Vermont, where he lived as a recluse for nearly 20 years before returning to post-Soviet Russia. His exile self-imposed, of course. It was a refuge from both KGB harassment and, I am guessing, Western rejection. Solzhenitsyn didn't understand America, it was said, even, or should I say specifically, after he died at age 89 in 2008. I think it's just as much the case that America didn't understand, couldn't understand Solzhenitsyn. We grew angry with him, impatient anyway, particularly after his famous 1978 Harvard commencement address. A surreal coda to this hotly debated address would follow in Moscow, as described by Andrew and Matrokin, when a large, even unprecedented group of senior Kremlin and KGB officials came together to assess the impact of Solzhenitsyn's critique of the West, delivered at one of its most hallowed, but also hollow, citadels. Together, these murderers and gangsters sat through a Kremlin screening of the Solzhenitsyn commencement address, that measure of bitter truth the writer doled out to America's best and brightest and their doting parents, a highly privileged group of Americans lightly moistened by a June drizzle over Harvard Yard. Hard-bitten party leaders and senior KGB spies watched the hated one denounce the silence and inertia of Western collusion with communism, the moral poverty of materialism, the spiritual wasteland of freedom without purpose. No doubt they also sat through an apparatchik's report on the opprobrium from the U.S. media that, in response, had come down on the head of the former Soviet dissident. Now, in effect, practically a Western dissident as well. What next? Would a new round of active measures be in order? Some new vector of desinformatia? Another insertion of spies masquerading as dissidents into the Solzhenitsyn household? No. This time, according to Matrokin's notes, the Soviets decided Solzhenitsyn had really done it to himself. His critique had alienated his American listeners and his continued use in anti-Soviet propaganda.
So, to conclude, comrades,
the meeting of the KGB and party notables agreed that no active measures were required to counter the Harvard Address. Solzhenitsyn had discredited himself. Solzhenitsyn was neutralized, finally. Or is it that we were neutralized, again? I'm still stuck on those dates he had brought to our attention a few years earlier, 1933 and 1941, diplomatic recognition of the USSR, and military alliance with the USSR. On November 7th, 1933, we feted the wrong passenger debarking from the Berengaria. All eyes were on Maxim Litvinov, who in 9 days would, as noted in Chapter 7, return to his Soviet comrades a few blocks away from the White House with a signed agreement on recognition and announce, "It's in the bag." In The Forsaken, Tim Siliadis relates that also disembarking from the Berengaria, but from steerage class, was a fugitive American trade unionist named Fred Beale, who had escaped from the Soviet Union, already a prison, under a false identity. Employed by the Communist Party to work with Americans in Kharkov at a tractor plant, Beale had made a couple of unauthorized field trips outside the city into terror famine territory, seeing, feeling, and smelling the horror of the painful deaths of millions by state-engineered starvation. His testimony, like that of so many others, would be virtually ignored. Suliadis writes, "On his return to America, for all of his radical contacts, Fred Beale could find only one newspaper willing to print his account of the famine that had claimed an estimated 5 million lives. The socialist Jewish Daily Forward of New York published his testimony in Yiddish. No one on the left wanted to hear about the terror famine. They didn't want to hear about it from a fugitive trade unionist such as Beale. They hadn't wanted to hear it earlier in the year from a disillusioned British socialist like Muggeridge, a Welsh freelancer like Jones, Ukrainians of any stripe. They hewed to the Soviet line as laid down by Litvinov, who, in response to a famine query from U.S. Representative Herman Koppelman, a freshman Democrat from Connecticut, swept into office with Roosevelt, answered thus, 'Thank you for drawing my attention to the Ukrainian pamphlet. there is any amount of such pamphlets full of lies circulated by the counter-revolutionary organizations abroad who specialize in work of this kind. There is nothing left for them to do but spread false information and forge documents. We find this Litvinov letter of January 3, 1934, excerpted in the Congressional Record, but for much of the preceding year, leading up to diplomatic recognition in November of 1933, as conquest made palpably clear, the truth was widely available in the West, with full or adequate reports appearing in scores of papers. The subject didn't even merit a mention in U.S.-USSR negotiations over recognition, however. This means that ignoring or even tolerating the millions killed by the state-engineered terror famine was in fact a prerequisite to recognition, that unprincipled deal with totalitarianism, as Solzhenitsyn almost lightly called it. This makes recognition a political sin of epic, also biblical, proportions. Dennis J. Dunn agrees with historian David Mayers, who has argued that the failure of the U.S. government under Roosevelt to reckon with the profound crime of the terror famine in negotiations over recognition made it, us, a passive accomplice to Stalin in the Ukraine. I agree. Which makes 1933 the year of America's fall. Martin Weil cites a diary entry of the time expressing similar concern. It was written by Ella Phillips, wife of Undersecretary of State William Phillips, who opposed recognition. "We are only following the majority of other Christian countries," she wrote, "but in so doing, I feel we have lost our moral standing. It is sad and demoralizing when we lose our honor for expediency." Weil continues. Joseph Grew in Tokyo echoes Mrs. Phillips' reservations. Recognition constituted a serious sacrifice of principle and letting down of standards. The United States, he insisted, should never palliate by recognition the things Soviet Russia has done and the things it stands for. Alas, that is exactly the impact of the U.S. recognition, to palliate the colossal crimes of Soviet Russia, most of which, incredibly, still lay ahead, and all that the evil empire stood for. Indeed, in the unjustifiable act of recognition itself, the answers to my questions begin to take shape. Having thrown the cover of normalcy over the USSR despite its colossal crimes, despite its revolutionary and repressive collectivism, we became complicit in and transformed by both. In 1941, this was the year of American military alliance with the USSR, a relationship that quickly morphed into an unseemly episode of something akin to fealty to the USSR, certainly in communist-occupied Washington, a subservient worker-queen relationship that would have the effect of entrenching and extending communist dominion in the world. I think of 1941 as the second chance not taken. On a course of convergence set by FDR 8 years earlier, the American people were now harnessed to power communism forward across the continents, from Berlin to Peking and beyond. It didn't have to be that way. Just for a moment, indulge in a diplomatic daydream based on a State Department memo Martin Weil fished from the archives for his history of the Foreign Service, A Pretty Good Club. The memo was written in 1941, during that last summer before America entered the war. I like to think it was a beautiful Washington day, long after the cherry blossoms, of course, but still in the thick of roses and clematis, before Washington's springtime green overblooms itself into swampy summer. It's a good bet State Department office windows were open in those pre-air conditioning days. Maybe a passerby heard the percussive beats of a manual typewriter as Loy Henderson, a resolutely anti-communist Foreign Service officer, tapped out a plan for the United States in the increasingly likely even expected event that Hitler's Germany attacked Stalin's Russia. Somewhere along a line of battle, 4 or 5,000 miles away from Foggy Bottom, as indeed the Germans would do in launching Barbarossa the very next day. It was June 21st, 1941. The correct American response, according to the man at the typewriter, was to do very, very little. After Nazi Germany attacked Communist Russia, Henderson wrote, the United States should merely relax restrictions on exports to the Russians, while securing a quid pro quo for further assistance. In other words, there should be nothing automatic or unlimited about expanding lend-lease, to bulk up the communist regime. Pay as you go, maybe, or exchange service for service. Weil sums up, finally, should the Soviet regime fall, Henderson argued, we should refuse to recognize a communist government in exile, leaving the path clear for the establishment of a non-communist government in Russia after the war. Finally, should the Soviet regime fall, the sky won't fall too. This is a cloud-parting concept, revealing beacons of a never-before-glimpsed light. Finally, should the Soviet regime fall, we should let it. Finally, should the Soviet regime fall, an anti-communist government could take its place after the war. At least at the U.S. State Department, there was life after Stalin, contingency plans after communist Russia. But this, circa 1941, was subversive talk. A Soviet collapse was not a point of open debate at the time or since. The linchpin of U.S. military alliance in 1941 was the sacredness of the survival of Soviet Russia. Washington wasn't communist-occupied for nothing. Henderson went further in Weil's paraphrase, urging the U.S. government to declare, Russia does not fight for the same ideals as the United States. Such common sense would have, could have, quite literally changed the world. But to say that the Roosevelt administration took the opposite tack is to miss the point. In declaring, as it did, that Russia fought for the same ideals as the United States, the Roosevelt administration wasn't merely lacking common sense. The Roosevelt administration was lying. For example, FDR himself went before the press on September 30th, 1941, insisting there was freedom of religion in the USSR. The claim that Stalin's Russia allowed religious freedom was the first step in a massive pro-Soviet campaign that the White House coordinated for the duration of the war, Dennis J. Dunn writes. Dunn argues that as a believer in convergence, FDR probably believed the Soviets would change, and probably, I would add, because Harry told him so. Nonetheless, it was still a big lie, made in the USA, and it confused an already mixed-up populace. Soon after Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia were at war with each other, William C. Bullitt was troubled enough to inform FDR on July 1, 1941, that public opinion is now befuddled by a belief that communists have become the friends of democracy. Bullitt suggested the president use his very next press conference to disabuse us all and point out that communists in the United States are just as dangerous enemies as ever and should not be allowed to crawl into our productive mechanism in order later to wreck it when they get new orders from somewhere abroad. That'll be the day. As described earlier, under Lend-Lease and other government efforts, communists were in fact invited into our productive and propaganda and military and other mechanisms, and even warned by co-president Harry Hopkins when they got too close for FBI comfort. As for seeking the end of the communist regime, on the contrary, the Roosevelt administration threw itself into shoring up the USSR at any cost, including, say, the 23 out of 34 ships lost on just one Lend-Lease Supply Voyage in July 1942, or, say, the 151,000 troops left unsupplied on the Philippines, or, say, the British colony of Singapore, which was left without air cover in order to satisfy Stalin's needs. If that wasn't enough, by mid-1943, as we've seen, the White House, having been presented with a list of officials who were supposedly undermining American relations with Russia by Soviet Ambassador Maxim Litvinov, resumed the purge of anti-communist Foreign Service officers begun in 1937. The first round, quite possibly at the behest of, but at least with the support of Eleanor Roosevelt and our friend Harry Hopkins, according to Weil, abolished the Division of Eastern European Affairs, too anti-communist, and sent its chief, Robert Kelly, a true scholar of Russian foreign relations who had opposed Soviet recognition, off to Turkey to finish his career. This so-called New Deal reorganization of the State Department also called for the destruction of the best Soviet library in the United States, as Loy Henderson called it. Well, not destruction, at least not in the crudest sense of the word. In his memoir, George Kennan elaborated, "The beautiful library was to be turned over to the Library of Congress, to be dispersed there by file numbers among its other vast holdings, and thus cease to exist as a library." Kelly's lieutenant, Raymond Murphy, Weil writes, was ordered to destroy his dossiers on communists, foreign and domestic. Murphy managed to save a considerable portion, Weil tells us in a footnote, later turning them over to the CIA. All of which is incredible, but commonplace for the Roosevelt years. It is also commonplace in the Obama years, during which both the Justice Department and the Pentagon have overseen methodical purges of anti-Islamic educational materials from security and military files and training courses. A half-century before M. Stanton Evans began stumbling across the sinkholes and crevices in our archives where national records once existed, Representative Martin Dies discovered that the government's archives of communist records and correspondence had similarly been destroyed. Dies wrote, "I was informed, confidentially, by a man well-placed in the Department of Justice, that they were destroyed after it was learned that the Dies Committee was determined to conduct a full-scale investigation of communism. Since the Dies Committee was up and running by 1938, the sacking of the State Department library took place in the same general time frame. What do you know, it was Harry Hopkins, along with the Attorney General, who turned down Dies' request for assistance from Roosevelt to help furnish the nascent committee with a staff of lawyers, investigators, and stenographers. Imagine, had the CPUSA records been saved, how many formerly card-carrying communists would have been cheated of their grandstanding moment taking the fifth." Of course, as Dies also pointed out, the CPUSA stopped issuing cards after his committee opened shop. But I digress. Following the second great State Department purge in 1943, Loy Henderson, author of the June 1941 fantasy memo, was sent to Iraq. Raymond Murphy was also taken out of the Soviet loop, and another anti-communist Foreign Service officer, Ray Atherton, was made ambassador to Canada. Henderson was completely removed from the sphere of Russian affairs during the war period for advocating a strong line vis-à-vis the Soviets. In 1942, between purges number 1 and number 2, Murphy wrote a memo to Henderson. "Current communist tactics are to force from government service any public official who will not go along with what they conceive to be the best interests of the Soviet Union and the Communist Party of the United States." Guess what? Current communist tactics worked. Because the American way and the Soviet system were diametrically opposed, FDR had to lie to present common ground to the American people. In order to make his big lies stick, he also had to remove the people who knew better, literally. On a larger and more punitive scale, Kravchenko discussed the same process in action. Easier to converge that way. That doesn't mean we got away with anything. Not really. The reckoning Solzhenitsyn urged upon us so many decades ago remains relevant. That's because, from the beginning, one big lie has begotten another big lie, and maintaining them to this day, moving them through the air in perpetuity, like jugglers' balls, makes us all big liars. With this in mind, it is instructive to go back to the double standard in U.S. foreign policy that historian Dennis J. Dunn pegs specifically to FDR's embrace of convergence theory, the theory that held that the Soviet Union and the United States would meet, ideologically and operationally speaking, roughly halfway, and any concessions, moral and other, were a price worth paying. I think Dunn's right. The perpetually blinded eye, the unstinting apologetics, the customary capitulations, the nullifications of promises, devalued contracts, pointless treaties, and empty words, all of this transformed the conduct of U.S. foreign affairs and the U.S. citizens charged with conducting them, as well as the people who voted for them. It went farther than that and deeper, especially as our institutions, political, media, entertainment, academia, religious, philanthropic, were targeted and also infiltrated by this communist army of occupation. The double standard in foreign policy Dunn seized on became double, triple, innumerable standards all around us. It wasn't long before we labeled the resulting morass moral relativism and wondered genuinely, sincerely, brows furrowed, stumped, where it all could possibly have come from. This is where it came from. The chain of big lies to which we hitched ourselves, tied ourselves, the noose constricting with each new lie. Our history necessarily became one of suppression, while desperation colored our relations with the USSR, all because we had things to hide too. Take the 2 million miserable repatriated victims. Fact, the implication, the Gulag Archipelago, was not just a monument to communist crime. It was also a repository of Western guilt, a locked pit of our own complicity, where the secrets of our weakness stay well hidden. And I haven't even covered the half of it. What did we get in exchange? The myth of the good war, the notion of American exceptionalism. These are only slogans. In the treaties and alliances between putative land of liberty and dead-to-rights communist totalitarianism, the United States exchanged foundational principles and guiding ideals for nothing, empty words, false promises, vain, destructive dreams. As truth, eyewitness reality itself lost its authority, its pride of place, even its relevance. A vacuum appeared. In this vacuum, facts are weightless. Conclusions disappear, judgment becomes a relative thing, and implications founder in emotionalism and ritual. Reckonings are put off indefinitely, no matter how many millions of corpses demand them. Not that there's anything figurative about corpses. In our brave new world, however, the impartial authority of evidence, whether observed by a Jones or Jordan, amassed by a Conquest or Epstein, or lived by a Solzhenitsyn, stacks up in heaps, unclaimed, unwanted, like so many deliveries on the porch of a vacant house. What are we supposed to do with them? This is the question that stumps even our very best scholars. For example, in the landmark espionage work The Haunted Wood, the authors make plain that the truth is that a large number of American agents and sources carried on espionage for Soviet operatives throughout the New Deal and war years. Check. Yes, they continue. These same agents turned over the most sensitive secrets to Soviet intelligence, including secrets related to building an atomic bomb. Check. Additionally, the authors add, they themselves didn't even draw on all the evidence they collected. In other words, they only told us the half of it. However, in their concluding words, the authors seem not to flinch exactly, but to take a modest turn. In their telling, the civilizational subversion and national theft boils down to something ultimately personal, something that happened to the agents. In the end, the enduring legacy of those Americans who sacrificed country for cause is one of the inglorious constancy to a cruel and discredited faith. Inglorious constancy. That's it? This was the red plot against America, against the whole world, not the red plot against a few agents. The sorrows or disappointments, maudlin or genuine, of a web of traitors are trivial next to the tragedies these traitors inflicted on humanity itself. But that's too much for us, too all-consuming. Better to recoil, withdraw, look within or away. Enough. The scene of the crime is on the next page.